Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have Pastor David George Moore with us. He's a prolific author. His latest book is Pooping Elephants, Mowing Weeds, What Business Gurus Failed to Tell You. And he writes in both scholarly and popular genres. He is also the founder and head of Two Cities Ministries. And we connected over a couple of issues that he has addressed in recent times. He has a paper that I thought would become our first topic for the conversation here, and that is in these times of conflict, political and cultural conflict, tensions are rising within families that we hear about. In fact, I saw one statistic that 1 in 5 people have stopped talking to a family member because of political disagreement in our age. So people are looking for ways to maintain their fidelity to their political beliefs while also being able to engage civilly in discussion, debate, and argumentation. And you have a nice little paper here called Stepping into Controversy with Courage and Christ-like Character. Is it possible in our divisive and turbulent time? So that'll be our show. Welcome, Pastor Moore.
Thanks very much, Mark. Great to be with you.
All right. So what prompted this paper here?
Well, it probably goes back to at least 2015 or so. I've certainly been thinking about this for many years, but probably the ultimate catalyst to really do something to start teaching on it. I'm going to be teaching a course near the University of Texas here pretty soon on this. Just noticing the rancor and the name calling and the just awful ways that friends and family members were treating one another leading up to the election, and then obviously since Donald Trump getting elected, immensely troubled. And what I found really disheartening is a lot of Christians telling me that they can't even talk to some of their best friends who are also Christians about their differences politically. So that was really the animating influence. I think there's a lot of feeder streams that go with that. And I've certainly been thinking about those feeder streams for quite a while.
You know, I have to say in my lifetime, I was born in 1959, I can't recall any parallel situation in which among so many people, the political disagreements were having such a destructive effect in so many other areas than politics. I mean, in personal relations, in workplaces, and certainly on the internet, all the time. Have you ever seen political differences cause such disruption in people's personal lives and relationships before? I mean, and you know, we talk about the 60s, right? You know, 1968.
Right.
I was a child then, but I don't remember it entering into the personal sphere quite so much in everywhere the way it has now.
Yeah, I was born in 58, so I've got you by a year. Of course, as you know, you know, the Adams-Jefferson election in 1800, if they had had access to social media, who knows what that would have looked like. So I think human nature being the way it is, I think we don't want to so privilege these times as being unique in the sense of the rancor, the divisiveness. I do think the social media certainly just spins it way out of control, because now you can do it in, quote, real time, which is such a weird thing that we tag as doing it right immediately, not thinking about things. But I think part of it, Mark, I would say, and you've already kind of touched on it, saying the political differences. One of the things that I'm trying to do in this seminar, in this class that I'm doing on stepping into differences, is getting people to slow down and agree on certain definitions. So, for example, politics or political, that is thrown out constantly, you know, whether it's cable news or wherever it is, informal conversations among friends. And it's almost never, literally almost never defined. So I had a conversation, a friend wanted to set up a conversation between me, who has been very public about my concerns about Trump, and another friend who has voted for him. And I don't think gladly, I think he held his nose a bit, but certainly is pretty pro-Trump. And then this third friend just kind of wanted to watch us discuss. So his leading question was, hey, let's talk openly about your political differences. So I said at the beginning, I said, well, before we get into that, could we have a working definition of politics or political? Because I think most Americans, including most Christian Americans, when they think of politics or being political, they think about it, in my estimation, in a very shrunken way, meaning simply, politics is synonymous with who you are going to vote for or who you're going to definitely not vote for. I like to use it in its more ancient meaning, where you're looking at the polis, the city, obviously the word comes from that, and looking at what good am I to do as a political being. So when people say things like religion and politics shouldn't mix, it's almost like saying to me, religion and life shouldn't mix. I mean, I have a very, I think it's, I'm on solid footing here, a more expansive view of what it means to be political. So I think part of the problem is, I think it was Alfred North Whitehead, though I've asked philosopher friends and no one can really tell me for sure, but I think he said that most debates are worthless because the opposing sides assume that they're pouring in the same meanings into salient words, and they're really not. And they're just flying by each other and getting frustrated. And really, if they slow down and agreed on some working definition of important words, the debate may be more fruitful. So I really want, I would love to see a conversation like, you know, we see it on the cable news all the time, right? When someone says something nasty or underhanded, they go, oh, look, they're being political. So political has this very derogatory, you know, negative view and or meaning connotation, I should say. So I think that's a big part of it, is that we are such a frenetic soundbite culture that slowing down and saying, let's have some, you know, discussion about what some of these words actually mean.
What do you do? Because I think you're right. Getting down to just basic semantics is crucial. But what do you do when the other side really redefines your words in a way that you say, you know, as T.S. Eliot would say, no, that's not what I meant at all. That isn't what I meant. So that if you say, well, I think that homosexuality is a disordered condition and homosexual acts are sinful, and someone says, well, that's hate speech. So that someone's given a new meaning that you may not, I didn't intend this at all. What do you do in that circumstance?
Well, I think here's where we have some big advantages, and I don't mean that in a power play sort of way, but I mean in just a genuine sense, we have big advantages as Christians, because one thing I'm trying to work hard at, and I don't always succeed at this, is, you know, Romans chapter 12, verse 18 says, if possible, so far as depends on you, be at peace with all men. Now, Jesus says in Luke 6, be concerned when all men speak well of you. So I think our responsibility is to live within those two tension points, to say, okay, I don't want, or as Peter says in his epistle, you know, make sure that when you're persecuted as a Christian, not as a murderer, not as a thief, etc. So I think one thing we have responsibility, and it's a serious responsibility as Christians, is to make sure we're well prepared and we're gracious. And yet there's still going to be conversations. It's not a panacea, of course. There are going to be conversations, maybe many conversations, where we have those impasses, where we have maybe someone using a debate trick or some rhetorical device to get us to accept that saying, for example, that we believe homosexuality is a sin, that we're therefore, then we have to accept that we're a hateful person. And we want to say, no. I have friends that are homosexual. I just think that's wrong. And so I think we need to work really hard on being well-prepared and making sure our manner is gracious, but yet still realizing that there still may be those problems where we go, I'm being totally misrepresented. This is not what I mean. This is not fruitful. And the Bible gives categories for that, too. I mean, obviously, in the book of Proverbs, there's tons of stuff about, you know, that you can speak to someone who certainly is willing to listen, but there are people that are unwilling to listen. And I just think we need to make sure that we're not that person.
And you acknowledge, you know, there are some conversations that just can't happen. I mean, all I can say is I don't feel any hate.
Right.
And if someone insists, no, you do, that is hate, I think you just smile and say, no, that I really don't. And let it go there. I mean, there are some things you just can't argue, right?
I think that's definitely the case. I mean, the greatest persuader of all, we could say, Jesus Christ, couldn't persuade everybody. And so, you know, I think if like in philosophy, if the greater is true, the lesser is true. And I don't even compare myself to Jesus, but I mean, take the Apostle Paul, take some great person that you kind of go, wow. I mean, Martin Luther King, I just read a terrific book on him, and he was trying to persuade certain groups that wanted to use violence to not use violence. And for all his rhetorical abilities, was not able to do it. So I think we need to use every arsenal we can, both in being well prepared in our manner, but at the end of the day, yes, you're right. There may be conversations that we walk away and just go, I wish I could have a conversation here, but I've tried everything I can do. I just can't.
You know, you have one word of advice here. Read those who make you angry.
I'm glad you picked up on that.
I think it's important there to expose yourself to things that initially make you angry, but then you do it again and you're going to find yourself a little less angry. You'll do it again and the anger will steadily go down and you will start to fashion some counter arguments, some disconfirming evidence on that figure, so that when you do hear it later on, the anger won't pop up because you've heard it before. You know what this is. It's not going to surprise you, and you're ready. Sometimes you feel the anger at things you read are because you feel a little frustration or helplessness to counter what you've heard. You know it's wrong, but you haven't quite articulated why it is wrong and developed your response. When you do, I think your anger will go down, yes?
Yes. And I think there's also your longtime colleague there at Emory, Luke Timothy Johnson, wrote a terrific book called Living Jesus. And in it, he retrieves the ancient mathane pathane, that to learn is to suffer. And because if you're really going to be a learner, you have your hands open, your heart is open, and you're saying, OK, I want to be discerning, but I may be really wrong on something. And sometimes we can find out where we may be wrong or where there may be a blind spot, like stuff within the church, the Christian church that we're both committed to. The critique of maybe a Nietzsche, as frustrating as it may be to read him and to see what he says about the use of power and all this sort of thing, there may be something that he crafts in such a way, because he's not beholden to be loyal to the church, that we need to hear, and that he uniquely can offer a perspective that it's like, wow, that is blind side, a spot of religious people, and that is something I need to consider.
You have to expose yourself to the best of the other side. Very, very important. So I've talked to conservative students before, especially the more libertarian type conservatives, and I ask them, have you read Marx? And they often give me sort of a strange look. What are you telling us to read Karl Marx for? The man was wrong, and he had a demonic influence on world history. And my response is, you've got to know the foundational ideas and texts of the other side. You must read Marx. In fact, you have to know Marx better than they do. That helps you win, and we want to win in a debate. But also, it makes you understand that other side more. It gives you, you're granting the other side a little more depth than just saying they're wrong. You get the genesis of their ideas, even if you find them distorted. They are worth investigating.
Well, it's exactly what Augustine did with City of God, that he went in and he knew the alternative views. Obviously in that book, trying to be an apologetic and say Christians were not responsible for the fall of the Roman Empire. And yet he knew the alternative stories and the philosophies better than most of the people who were proponents of them. And then he shows, incrementally how the incarnation really fulfills the desires of all human beings. So it's exactly what you're talking about, where he knew the alternative stories. Aquinas did this as well, and Summa Contra Gentiles. They knew the stories better than those who held them, and then could show gently and with great intellectual rigor, credibility, how the incarnation really gave people what they really desired in life. And, it takes a lot of work and people find that daunting. But, as Christians, it's like, the Christian faith is a wonderful, full-orbed, beautiful faith. And why wouldn't we want to learn it better? And so I think we have a lot of models before us we can look to.
Right. I try to tempt my son into doing more reading, a little more homework, by saying, my guy, it's a nice feeling when you know what the other people in the room are talking about. It's not a good feeling when you don't know what they're talking about. It gives you kind of a warm security when you are aware of what the other people are referring to. And if you know that other material better than they do, it feels real good. So this is what I offer for him. He doesn't always follow that bait, unfortunately. But anyway, let's turn to another subject. You say you're working on a project.
Yes.
And you're not writing about the nuns, as we hear N-O-N-E-S, those young people in particular who declare themselves of no religion. Not necessarily atheists, but they don't have no specific religion. But you are looking at a different category, and you call them the duns. D-O-N-E-S. What are the duns?
The duns, it's not my category. It's a sociologist of religion have categorized. These are folks that would still say that they hold to the Orthodox Christian faith. They're just done with formal church attendance and kind of all the organizations that go with that, but mainly churches. And so they've left churches. They now worship at home with their family. So they are fed up, done with organized church life in America.
Are they people who would say, well, I'm not religious, but I'm very spiritual? They're a little more formal than that.
No, yes. They wouldn't say that. In fact, they would, and I've talked to a number of them, the nuns would maybe fit in more the category that you're describing, though the nuns typically say that, I really don't have any religious affiliation. I'm just, I have nothing and there's none. That's why the category kind of stuck in the mid-90s as people were increasingly checking, I don't have any of these categories that you're listing here to check off. I'm none of these. The Duns are, again, those who would say, I still believe in Jesus Christ. I believe he's the savior of the world. I believe the divinity of Christ. I believe the Trinity, virgin birth.
And they could be at home. They could engage in fairly systematic Bible study. They would have their weekly devotions. Yeah.
Sure. Absolutely. And they might even, say that that's a more pure form of Christianity. I've certainly had a lot of conversations. I know former church leaders, both elders and pastors, who are in this category of being done with church. I think there's a lot of reasons for it, Mark.
Yeah, I think why did they were they strongly within a church at any time and found something about the church, something happened that sent them away, a new church leader turned them off? Why do they become duns?
Well, like a lot of things, there's a lot of factors. I would say you could boil them down to two categories of external factors and internal factors. And what I mean by that external factor would be, say, like an abusive church leader, something that happened to them with, from another person that was nasty and they just felt like was, a deal breaker. The internal reasons would be the stuff that all of us struggle with, namely that we come to church and we want to hang out with our friends. We have a consumer mentality. We're still individualists. We don't want to be part of a community. We want to be part of what Robert Bell and his associates said, a lifestyle enclave where people like us, I want to hang out. If I come to your church, I want to hang out with Mark Bauerlein because he's a thoughtful, fun guy. And he gives me a lot of energy and it's just easy to hang out with Mark Bauerlein. But I don't want to just indiscriminately hang out with anybody. That's a selfish Dave Moore talking. So Dave Moore comes to church and has to work hard to remember to go outside my own comfort zone and realize I'm part of a body and I need to reach out to other people very different than me. And so I think when people come with a consumer kind of individualistic perspective, which we all do to varying degrees, and they're immature spiritually, they don't understand the Christian faith, one of being a servant to others and giving your life away to find it, then if church starts to become uncomfortable, they feel like, wow, they're having to extend themselves and do things that, doesn't fit their selfish agenda. Those can be internal factors that cause a person to go, this is just too hard. I don't want to, use the Chesterton thing. It's not that it hasn't been tried. It's just been too hard. It's just too hard to do this. I don't want to do this anymore. So I think there's both external and internal.
Do you find that the Duns are able to sustain their faith, their commitment on their own in this way? Does it last?
That's a great question. And that's a difficult question, I think, to answer definitively, because there's a lot of ways I could go about how difficult it is. One difficulty would be that there's no sense of an individual Christian prospering in Scripture. I mean, whether you take something from the Old Testament like Proverbs, he who separates himself seeks his own desire. He quarrels against all sound wisdom. You take the idea of the body of Christ in the New Testament. There's no sense of an individualized in the modern sense of I worship God on my own.
I hadn't thought of that. It is right. It's all corporate. The Catholic Catechism, one of those opening pages, says it's we. It's a we statement. We believe, not I believe. It's a we believe. But, my natural inclination is that human beings need an institutional structure to sustain their faith against many sources, within and without. But I wouldn't want to make a principle on my own out of that. I just would like to see how the Duns fare after a few years?
I think it's going to be, even if they still say they subscribe to the Orthodox tenets, which again, some of the folks I know have been gone from church for maybe 5, 8, even 10 years, you know, they would still say they subscribe to those Orthodox tenets, but I know that there's no way they can be prospering spiritually like they're designed by God, because they're supposed to be in a body. And Hebrews 3:13 says we can be deceived by the deceitfulness of our own sin. Therefore, we need the encouragement of others. I mean, if you're your own reference point in the kind of the modern enlightenment sense, you know, the self is individual, I'm totally full within myself and nothing outside of myself, then you are open to all kinds of rationalization, compromises, and you don't even know it. And so I don't think you can be doing very well. And the Bible is really, really clear on that.
I begin to see why you mentioned in your writings a couple of times, Ralph Waldo Emerson is a genuine antagonistic, interesting, but antagonistic figure, the self-reliant one. You know, the trust thyself, as Emerson says, and maybe the more conservative or the more experienced position is, I really have to be wary of trusting myself too much.
Absolutely, and I think Emerson's interesting because, I mean, we are swimming, as I said in another piece. I don't know if I sent this to you, but we're swimming in Emersonian waters. We don't really know it, but they're very consistent with what we want as these hyper-individualized Americans, including a lot of us as Christians. And I've been surprised that there hasn't been as much interaction from Christian scholars on Emerson and really responding to him. I don't know why that is. If I were to write a dissertation, I would maybe want to tackle that, but it's an area I feel like there needs to be more work on him. He's really significant, as you know.
I think he says at one point, the only thing sacred is the integrity of my own soul.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Okay. Well, here's another problem I think that the Duns would face, and that is passing on their faith to children. You know, you do it all by yourself? I think of when I was coming back into the Catholic Church, my son, who was only 6 or 7 years old at the time, he would go into church and he would look around at those high windows and he would see the people coming in with some candles, and the ritual, the organization of it all really, really affected him. And I take that as a very good sign of the importance of the organization of religion.
Absolutely. I think that is a sobering reality, that the passing on of the faith. I mean, I've been really grateful for other men. We have two sons who have done things with them and have spoken truth into their life, been wonderful models, have strengths in areas where I don't, and I've been able to do that with other young men myself. And having that collaborative communal effort, you know, when you're on your own, you really don't know what you're missing. And again, it's really arrogant to think all the resources reside within you as an individual. That's just really antithetical to Scripture and the Christian tradition.
But I have the sense from you that you find, in at least in some cases, the reasons why the Duns became Duns is understandable.
Yes, absolutely. And that's where I think we, meaning those around us that see it happening. And the most difficult thing is when you have a minister, and I mean very public by the sense of, you know, maybe they're writing, they have a big church, they're a face of Christianity in the media, et cetera. When that's going on, and I've certainly seen people like this, that it's typical they don't have strong leaders around them. And it's just a disaster. People get hurt, and those people that get hurt, we really need to, we need to prevent this stuff. We need a better job of preventing it, and there's things we should do much better there. But when it actually happens, those people have been hurt, need to really be wisely and compassionately ministered to, because that's brutal to go through that. I've seen certainly the wreckage up close.
Do you think the churches do enough to bring the duns back in?
No, I don't. In fact, I'll give you an example. When I was doing radio years ago, he didn't call them the duns, but a book by William Hendricks called Exit Interviews. It's probably written late 90s or so. And one of the studies looked at 400 people who had left their church. And so they looked at a sample size of 400 people who had left various churches. And then they asked the question of these 400 people, if someone had reached out to you within 6 weeks, I believe it was 6 to 8 weeks, and, you know, wanted to get together, talk to you on the phone, grab a cup of coffee, whatever, and try to woo you back to the church, would you have seriously reconsidered coming back? About half said, yes, I would seriously have reconsidered coming back. Then the follow-up question was, were you ever contacted? Out of those 400 people, Mark, do you want to guess how many of them were contacted by people trying to woo them back?
50.
They couldn't find one.
Oh, okay. Well, that tells you why a lot of them left, right?
Right. Yeah, we're done with it. Well, they were a troublemaker. They were critical. Maybe they were critical people, but still, that doesn't mean that their criticisms aren't valid, you know? And they could not find one person who was pursued and compelled to come back and given reason. And that to me is, I don't think it's gotten much better.
Yeah. Well, look, Pastor Moore, we will look forward to your work on the Duns, and as it comes forward, and maybe first things, maybe we'll get it out on our website when it does appear.
That sounds great. Thanks so much.
Thank you, sir.
Great being with you.